and say, welcome to the Laurel Mountain Highland area of North Carolina. This annual unity retreat, we would like you to join us in celebrating the recovery and fellowship that we have come to know and need and deserve in our lives. We encourage you to share in our NA unity through your experience, strength, and hope in our wide variety of workshops. This is an open retreat. All are welcome to attend. However, we ask only addicts share in the workshops. In accordance to the seventh tradition, we are fully self-supporting and thank you for registering. We would remember that our actions this weekend are a direct reflection on Narcotics Anonymous as a whole. Let's carry the NA message, not the mess. What is the NA message? Our message is that an addict, any addict, can stop using drugs, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. Our message is hope and the promise of freedom. When all is said and done, our primary purpose can only be to carry the message to the addict who still suffers, because that is all we have to give. That no addict anywhere need die from the horrors of addiction. The NA way. In our Narcotics Anonymous, we are presented with a dilemma. When NA members identify themselves as addicts and alcoholics, cross addicts, or talk about living clean and sober, the clarity of the NA message is blurred. To speak in this manner suggests that there are two diseases, that one drug is separate from the rest. Narcotics Anonymous makes no distinction between drugs. Our identification as addicts is all-inclusive, allowing us to concentrate on our similarities, not our differences. To the press, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. If any members of the press are present, please come to the registration table, where you will be referred to our public information chairperson. We respectfully ask that no pictures be taken during the unity retreat by the press. If any NA members are approached by the press, please refer them to the registration table. Remember, no one person represents NA. Please do not attempt to represent NA to the press alone. Thank you. Please observe no smoking in all buildings. Hello, everyone. I'm an addict, and my name is Philip. Welcome to this workshop entitled Faith versus Fear. Will we please open this meeting with a moment of silence for the addict who still suffers, followed by the serenity prayer. Amen. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And could we please have a reading of We Do Recover at the podium, please?
Hi, I'm Charlene. I'm an addict.
Hi,
we do recover. From at the end of the road, we find that we can no longer function as a human being, either with or without drugs. We all face the same dilemma. What is there left to do? There seems to be this alternative. Either go on as best we can to the bitter end, jail, institution, or death, or find a new way to live. In years gone by, very few addicts ever had this last choice. For those who are addicted today and more fortunate, for the first time in history, a simple way has been proving itself in the lives of many addicts. It is available to us all. This is a simple, spiritual, and not religious program known as Narcotics Anonymous.
Thank you. I would like to introduce the first speaker, Rick.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm an addict named Rick.
Hi, Rick.
I'm from the Southfield area, Narcotics Anonymous. My home group is Back to Basics in Houston, PA. I got to tell you, the circumstances of obtaining this topic and being asked to speak up here were just so ironic, the way this all happened. Of course, that's usually the way it always happens. I've learned from experience coming here. 2 days ago, I was up in the middle of the state, and I was supposed to go up there with my family and put a down payment down on a business, which represents a substantial risk for not just me, but for my family too. And as much as I've worked all the numbers out, and I 4 weeks ago I didn't even know what a purchase and loss statement was. Now I know all about them and got it all figured. At least I think I know. You know, some days I convince myself I know all about it. I know exactly why this business just didn't work and what I'm going to do to fix it. But I had to go up there to give the guy the non-refundable deposit to buy the business. And the way it all went down was, I left the house about 4 in the morning and I took my camper with me. And my family was supposed to go, but we have a 5-month-old baby boy. And he's starting to get a little bit of a cold. So my wife says, you go and take care of this. I'll stay home with the kids. So I ended up leaving out and having to go up and do this myself. So I went all the way up there about 4 hours from my home, which is over in south of Pittsburgh. And when I got up there, it was raining. It was about 9 o'clock. And instead of just putting that camper up, because I have a pop-up, and knowing it was going to get wet, and then having to pack it down, and then having to be in Bedford for a meeting the next morning, I figured I'd just go ahead and rent a little cabin, because they got those little cabins in a campground. So I rented a cabin, and I went down to downtown State College and met with the man and had lunch with him, and we conducted our business. In about 15 minutes, now I have thought about this decision. This is not a spur-of-the-moment decision. I've thought about this decision for the last 3 months. Within 1 hour after leaving his office, I wanted to turn around and go back, get that deposit back, fold up everything and go home. Within 1 hour. I fought that urge off. I'm riding around and I'm just filled with loneliness. I'm thinking, what am I doing to my family? Why am I going to do this? I mean, I have a killer job, which pays me more money than I would have ever thought I could ever make in my life. Helping people too. It's got all the rewards to it. The only problem is I got this boss and his daughter, who the president of the company is, who just absolutely treat everybody in the company like they're nothing, like they know nothing. And they have to do it that way to keep everybody stupid, because they make their money off by doing that. And it just got to the point where I've had enough is enough of this. And I know I can do this. I know I can do this. And the amazing thing in Narcotics Anonymous is all of the people in my recovery, all of the people that I'm close with, they've all told me numerous times, you can do this. This is you, and you can do this. You know, if anybody can make this work, you can do it. And hearing that over and over again, I get so filled with confidence. And then that confidence tends to fade away when I'm alone. Which brings me to the topic of faith versus fear, which in my interpretation breaks down as principle versus defect. Because one of them is a principle of Narcotics Anonymous, and the other one is a defect of my character. I got up early in the morning yesterday morning to attend a meeting in Bedford, which will be probably the last corporate meeting for the company that I work for. I was asked to give a presentation because they wanted to get the laugh out of me, they could get out of me and have everybody see what it is that I do that makes me the way I am. And I know that reason. It's because I came here. It's because I found this place. And when I got in the car and I started coming down 220 and I had a mountain on each side of me, I was completely overwhelmed and filled with fear. I'm calling my wife on the cell phone. I'm waking her up. Now, I could make a signal to talk to my wife for 20 minutes in the car, telling her, honey, it's okay. I'm willing to forfeit the money. I can stay at the job. Maybe I acted irrationally. After all, it's not too much shit I got to eat. And after all, it pays everything and gives us the lifestyle that we live. And she's like, she says, you just need to hold your position right now and don't make any decisions. Take care of what you have to take care of, go to that retreat, and come home, and everything's going to be all right. I heard her say that, but the fear still didn't lift. And I picked up the phone, and I called the corporate office, and I said, give me the CEO's cell phone number in his car, because I knew he was on his way to Bedford, coming out of Harrisburg, probably about the same time. And I just talked 20 minutes on the phone with my wife. I dialed that number in the cell phone. He answered the phone. He said, hello. I said, hello, John, how are you? This is Rick, and I need to talk to you. And specifically, the words that were going to come out of my mouth were, cut that new guy off you got in training right now, or put him in another office. You pay my family's benefits next year, and we'll negotiate another contract a year from now. We can work this out. And as I'm sitting on the phone spitting all this information out, the phone is crackling, sizzling, and all I hear is, hello, who is this? Hello, who is this on the other end of the line? And then it shut off. I immediately picked up the phone. I hit redial again. I get to that. It rings again. It rings again. I get, hello, hello, crystal clear. I start to talk. The signal cuts off. I'm looking at the tire. It's right on top of the mountain. I should be tapped into that signal. Every once in a while, I've learned in Narcotics Anonymous that my higher power steps right in and just says, he just throws his full committee and says, block that signal. That's not what I want him to do. That's not what I need him to do right now. I went to that meeting having not talked to him, never said a word to him about it, left the meeting and came directly over here. When I got over here, I pulled up in front of the registration table, and I was so happy to see addicts. So happy to see. You know what? There is no place in the world that I find more comfort than Narcotics Anonymous. And there has been no place that brings joy to my heart like attending a spiritual retreat. Some of you people, I see it at just about every retreat that I go to. And I know you travel far to attend these things. No distance is too far when you can get together with a group of addicts. For the time that I'm here at this retreat, there will be not a moment that I'll walk through here with fear. I'll be filled with faith the entire weekend, you know? My experience with checking at the registration table was when I walked up and signed in, a guy said to me, are you speaking? And I said, no, not this year. And he said, would you mind speaking for me? And I said, my exact words to him were, yeah, why don't you tell me what my higher power has in mind for me for this topic? And he says, faith versus fear. You know what? I didn't have to doubt it for a minute that came from the committee, you know? So I took my papers and went up and set up. And since I checked into this, I have thought over and over again about those two, faith versus fear. And I've looked back in my recovery and thought, you know, in the beginning of my recovery when I came to Narcotics Anonymous, the proportionate percentages of those two when weighed together would have looked like this. Fear! One was really little, and the other one was enormous. I just walked around continuously caught in the grip of fear. You know, and I have found in recovery that when I make decisions out of fear, they're always bad decisions. Always bad. When I make decisions out of faith, I'm making decisions out of love. When I make those decisions, I can live with the results. It reminds me of a little plaque that hangs in our home group. I see it every week when I go. It says, God's will never take you where God's grace cannot keep you. You know, all of my life in active addiction, somebody else was paying the bill. Somebody else always footed the bill for me. You know, it was my mother. It was my family. It was always somebody else that took the responsibility. I took no responsibility for the actions and the destruction that I caused. I come into Narcotics Anonymous and find that there is a certain price to be paid here, you know, and I pay the price. I choose to pay the price because somebody else paid it for me in the beginning when I got here. You know, the fear was so overwhelming. And I look back in my past. When I come down here to speak, I walked up to my trailer after the meeting, and I changed because it was getting cold. I was in shorts, and I put my long clothes on, and I'm gonna come down here and speak. So I'm gonna do what I always do that works. I'm gonna get down on my knees and pray. But I reach up and shut all the lights off on the camper because I don't want you to see me pray. Like we don't know you're praying, you know? Like you don't know I'm on my knees praying. I mean, the first time I ever in my life prayed was at Farmington in 1990. I had 10 days clean. A couple guys took me to that retreat, and we stayed in a tent. And it was an unbelievable experience. It rained all weekend. It was miserable. It was absolutely miserable. They got me there by telling me there's magic there. And you got to go to this thing. There's magic up there. You got to go. And I go up there to this retreat, and when I get there, the first thing I did was I took my fishing pole and went down to the lake. That lasted about 5 minutes. There was no magic down there, and the fishing wasn't very good either, at least not where I was standing. So I got in my car, and I rode up to the diner, because everybody was going up to the diner to eat pie, to do all kind of stuff. I went up there. There wasn't no magic up there. I saw a bunch of you addicts stuffing your faces, but I didn't see no magic going on. I walked through the campground. There wasn't no magic I could see. I went up to the cabins. I didn't see any magic. I finally ended up back down in the main lodge, and I walked in, and I saw a guy from my home group, Lance, if any of you know him. And I sat down, and Lance has a way of eating a hamburger like in three bites. I know, you know, he don't waste no time when he eats a burger. Anyway, he got a mouthful of burger in his mouth, and I looked at him. I said, "You know, Lance, I'm ready to pack up and go home." I said, "Ain't no magic here for me." And in between chewing on his burger, he uttered the words out and said, "Maybe you ought to slow down long enough for it to catch up to you." And I walked away and backed down a gear. And later that night, I sat at a campfire meeting up in the campground, and it was the first time that I had ever associated with addicts outside of a meeting or an Eaton Park. I thought that was the only two places you people were. I thought you went to work, you went to a meeting, you went to Eaton Park, you went home. That was your whole life, you know? And I didn't want much of what you had, you know? I was really, really a mess when I got here. The first meeting that I went to, I sat in the meeting, and as soon as the first guy next to me started sharing, he was talking about he couldn't get $400 together to get a car. I had nothing in common with that guy. So the next guy spoke. I didn't have anything in common with him either. The next guy spoke. Well, that guy was doing a lot better than I was, so he discounted him right away. I looked at everybody in one of two ways. Better than, less than. That was an awfully lonely existence because I walked around on nobody's playing field. There was nobody even. I always placed myself to be outside of everybody else. So I went up to Farmington to this retreat, and I had 10 days clean. And when I sat around the fire and I listened to everybody share, they go around in a circle. It just continuously, never ended, just kept going around. And these people were speaking, and they were at peace. They had something that I never knew. You know, they had what it says in the basic text, an end to the loneliness and a sense of direction. I didn't have that. My earliest childhood thought was a little red train that I had got for Christmas when I was probably 5. And this train would chart a course until it bumped something, turn around and go another direction until it bumped something, turn around, go another. That was how the first 30 years of my life were. I'd just keep going until I hit something. Turn, go somewhere else. Hit that, go somewhere else. You know, I can relate a lot to what people say about an addict with a hammer in his hand hanging a picture. Ow, that hurts. Ow, that hurts. Ow, that hurts. Ow, that just over and over again. That was the way that I lived. We were inside this tent up there in Farmington, and this guy took me up there. He was about 6 years younger than I was, and another guy. And we all went back to the tent to sleep, and the fire was glowing outside the tent. And I really looked up to these two guys, because the one guy, he had 8 months. That was a titan. That guy didn't take nothing for 8 months. I'm just coming off the string of the last 6 months when I couldn't get 30 days. 20 days I'd used. 25 days I'd used. And, you know, it kept getting shorter and shorter. It wasn't getting longer and longer. I was getting worse as I went. I went up there with 10 days clean, and we're sitting in this tent, and we're still laughing like little kids, like sixth graders. We're laughing in this tent. And the one dude looked at the other dude, Bernie. He turned to the other dude, and he said, "You know what?" He said, "We're going to go to bed now." Well, "We're going to pray first." And the two of them got down on their knees, side by side, next to their sleeping bags. And peer pressure caused me to get down on mine next to them. Just out of peer pressure. That was the only reason I got down on my knees. We said a prayer. The two of them went to sleep. I couldn't go to sleep. My head was just totally buzzing from all the information it had taken in around that campfire. That noise, the committee still on, you know. I got up out of the tent and I walked up in the woods, and it was still wet. It was late April. And I remember getting down on my knees up in the woods at that retreat, looking up at the sky and saying, "I have no idea who you are or what you're about, but if you could just help me get what they got, I would do anything for you." Sometimes I regret I made that promise. Every once in a while, the cost gets real high, you know? And it's worked, you know? It's worked. I mean, honest to God, nothing warms my heart like coming to a retreat, you know? The next time I got down on my knees, with fear was a string of bad relationships, you know? That if I could just get the right woman, you know? And looking back in my fourth step, I could see that every woman I was with was a cookie cutter of the last one. You know, I mean, they were all the same. There was no difference between them. All unhealthy. They all looked alike. There was a common pattern in there in the way they looked. You know, they all had to be noticeable. It was important that you notice them. And, you know, I'd show up at a dance in the beginning when I was new with a girl, and somebody would say, "What happened to Sherry?" And I'd say, "What do you mean? That is Sherry." I mean, Faith. You know what I mean? But I learned over time. I learned here. But I can remember being in a relationship that everybody told me was bad. Stay out of it. That's no good for you. You know, she was the prettiest woman I'd ever seen in my life. And I just followed her around. And as I did that, I got less and less involved in the program. I actually moved. You know, out a little bit further from my connection. And then one day she called me up in my office and said, "I gotta go, you gotta go, somebody's leaving. Now, what do you want to do?" I'm like, I was blindsided. What? I mean, actually, no one had ever left me at that. You know, I was very careful to get out before that ever happened. But this relationship ended, and I was caught up in some serious emotional pain. And I did the only thing at the time making a decision out of fear would allow me to do. I bought a Cadillac. It made no sense at all. It made absolutely no sense. I hunt, I fish, I camp. I do not need a Cadillac, okay? About 2 weeks after buying this car, I'm driving down the road going dove hunting, parking in cornfields, which is black sedan DeVille with a half top. But I looked like I was the mafia, you know? I'd go down to a farmer's house and knock on his door to go hunting. They wouldn't even answer the door. I know they were there. I pull up in a pickup truck. They say, "Hey, how you doing?" I pull up in that car. They're like, "Bill collector." You know? But it made no sense at all. But it was a decision that I made based out of fear. You know, it was a fear-based decision. I have a book that my mother had. And that book, the title of that book was "Everything Talks to Me." I kept it because I used to make fun of it so bad. I used to always tease her about it. "What kind of book is this? Everything talks to me." Today, through Narcotics Anonymous, everything talks to me. I know I'm wide open to the feelings of it. You know, I mean, I know when my higher power is with me. I know when he's available. And I know when he wants me to do something for him. You know, I've gotten that gift. About 3-4 years ago, I made a decision out of faith in 93. Bad string of relationships. Nothing was working for me. I got down on my knees and I surrendered. I said, "You know what, God? I don't suggest this for any of you newcomers. But I got on my knees and said, God, my selection in women is just bad. My criteria is all wrong. Why don't you just select the woman you want me to be with?" I went to the retreat in 93, the Southfield area retreat. I was on the security committee. We didn't call it that. I was like camp liaison, but my job was to tell you where to park or that you parked somewhere wrong. That was my thing, and help anybody out I could that needed help. And this girl had locked her keys in the car, and they came and got me, and I walked down, and they said, "Can you open a car without keys?" And I said, "You can put a right." I held the record at a car dealership once. I opened up a whole row in less than a minute. Once you have the hanger vent, it's real simple. But I went down over the hill, and this girl was standing there. And this was a girl who was absolutely out of the mold. Nothing in the mold. She had running pants on, a frumpy shirt. I couldn't even see what I was getting into. You know, I didn't even know what was under that sweatshirt. It was all bulky. She might have been not my type. I opened the car up for her, and she had to go somewhere. She had to go see family for something. And as soon as I popped the lock on that door, she turned around and reacted by jumping into my arms and hugging me. And as soon as that hug hit me, I wanted to back up. There was a feeling there that I couldn't identify with. And I turned around and I started to walk up, and my friend Jimmy C. turned to me and said, "I think that girl likes you." I said, "No, pal. Uh-uh. I'm going to wait to see what God has for me." See, that's the problem with faith. Sometimes it runs thin, you know. You don't know if the signal... Sometimes I got to be hit on the head with a sledgehammer before I'll surrender. Anyway, later that day, she came back to the retreat. I sat up at this tent we had set up at the registration area, and I started talking to her. I talked to her for 5 minutes. I turned to a friend of ours, Val, who's in Muncie right now, and I said, "Someday I'm going to marry that girl, Val." And she laughed. I married her. We have 2 kids. The greatest woman in the world. Absolutely the greatest woman in the world. And you know what? I know this in my heart. No one will love me the way that woman loves me. No one. You know, and I know that. A decision made in faith instead of fear-based decision-making. You know, that the fear thing, all my decisions will be based out of one of the two, either faith or fear. And if I'm not comfortable making a decision, I'll shop it around a little bit, you know, see what kind of reaction I'll get and try to stay out of the way, because I know my higher power will show up in there somewhere and tell me the real deal of what he wants me to do. We moved out to Cecil about 3 years ago, and we had 1 child at that time, a little girl, Hannah. She was an unbelievable gift that God has given us. And we have friends today. I got these friendships back in Pittsburgh. There's 3 families, husbands and wives, all in recovery. Husbands and wives all over 10 years clean. All in our 40s, husbands. Wives all in their 30s. We like to do that, I guess. But I don't know why it works that way. And we all have kids, and all the kids are close. And every week, we have dinner at one of the houses. We have a dinner with the family, you know? And we're real close. We got a really close connection. New Year's Eve, 2 years ago, we're at a New Year's Eve party at friends of ours' house. We're sitting at the dining room table, and we're playing poker. We're not all that healthy yet, so we're playing poker. If you've ever played cards, you know that sometimes luck's with you and sometimes luck isn't. There was no way I could lose on this table. I mean, it was every single hand. I could fill an inside straight from a, you know, it was just everything I did, I couldn't lose. We're sitting there playing, and the kids are playing downstairs, and there's people in every room of the house, and nobody's, like, high, and nobody's drinking, and nobody's arguing. Everybody's in recovery. There's a girl sitting at the table who I had seen 1 time in my life before at 1 meeting. We're playing Follow the Queen, and I got, like, 9 aces. I got every card in the deck. I can't be losing it. I got a guy with a straight flush, and he's betting into me. And I just keep going and going and going, and all of a sudden this girl, who I barely knew, she sighed like someone had let the life out of her. It was a moan of death. And she fell over and collapsed on Pam's lap, who was pregnant at the time. And immediately when she did that, everybody in that room began to go into a reactionary mode. One person went to the phone and hit 911. One person went to the top of the steps so the little kids wouldn't come upstairs while they were down there playing. She went into a convulsion. People left the room. In the blink of an eye, there's 2 of us standing there, me and Joe, one of the 3 guys in the group. Joe's a registered nurse, but he doesn't work in the field. We get her off of the chair, which is now shaking because she's going into a grand mal seizure. We get her on the floor. She goes through this seizure. She turns her head to the side, turns this really eerie shade of blue, and starts bleeding out of the corner of her mouth. Joe goes down for a pulse, goes up and leans into her mouth. He looks at me. He said, "She's gone." I'm standing there and I'm thinking about this. Her daughter's 9 years old. She's downstairs playing with my daughter, Hannah, and a bunch of other kids. And everybody's standing out of the room, and it's just me and Joe standing there. And I don't know this girl, but I've seen her from 1 meeting. And I could go into a whole lot of fear-based decisions right now, or I could just do what I know my higher power would want me to do. I said, "Get on her heart, Joe, and I'm going to give her CPR. I leaned in and I wiped her mouth out with my sleeve. I went down and I started breathing into her, and it took about 1.5 minutes, but after 1.5 minutes, she exhaled back into me. I leaned up, she started breathing, went right back into the seizure again. She come out of the seizure disoriented. The paramedics had arrived, and it took them like 20 minutes to get there. The paramedics got there and they put her on a gurney and they took her out. And all in one night, you know, all these people at this meeting were coming up, at the party were coming up to me and saying, "Man, that was huge. That was enormous. Where'd you learn that?" And I took a half a CPR class in 10th grade just so I could kiss this one instructor. That was the only reason I had any experience. That was it. That was the only experience I knew about it. But I knew this much about the experience that I had. It didn't matter if I had the experience. It was the effort and the willingness that was going to count. And Joe couldn't do it both. You had to. It would have. It's easier with two people. I knew that. A friend of mine walked up to me and said, "Man, I wish I could do that. I wish I could be that kind of person." And I said, "You know, all my life I've been trying to be the person I want me to be, and it's always turned out bad. I just try to be the person God wants me to be." And he said, "But you don't know her. You breathed into her. She was bleeding out her mouth." And I said, "Hey, don't be confused. I was scared. But I was more scared not to do it. Because if I stood there and just let her go and expire on the floor, knowing that there was a possibility that I could do something to save her, then I wouldn't have been loyal to my higher power. If God gave me the knowledge and the gift and stay in that room, God wanted me to do that." And he said, "Well, aren't you afraid? Because, you know, she's a junkie, you know? She might have some kind of infectious diseases." And I said, "You know what? If that's what God's will is for me, that's what I'll have to accept. I'd do the same thing over again. Because all my life, somebody else paid my check. You know, my wife to this day would tell you that my pet name is Huckleberry Finn. You know, I'll plan a dinner on Wednesday night when it's my turn and then have to work late and have everybody else there preparing my meal. Then I'll walk in at 7 o'clock, you know. And I try not to be that way. I try not to do those things today. I see that girl at meetings still, and she always wants to make a big fuss out of it or a big deal, you know. And I don't know that I have the heart to tell her it really didn't have a whole lot to do with her. You know, the thoughts going through my head were, "You can do this. You can do this for me. Don't let that little girl downstairs have to come up those steps and have her mother dead." You know? You know, I left here this afternoon. I had to go downtown and get some kind of grocery or something. And I hit my cell phone, and I called my messages. And there was a friend of mine from the program back home. And when I listened to his message, I couldn't tell you a word he said right now on that message until the last thing he said, which was exactly how we end our conversations. With all the men in my life that I'm close to, we end it one way: "I love you." I could have never told a man I love him, no how, no way, for fear of how you would judge me. I learned that here. You know, there's nothing more powerful than getting off the phone with a sponsee and having them say, "I love you." Sometimes I think they call just to hear that, just to let them know that I love you, man. Not only do I love you, I need you, you know. You know, I don't know when I leave this retreat how long my faith will stay strong in me. Because I can go back. That's the thing about fear-based thinking is, you know, with faith, I got to do some work. I have to work to get into that mode. But with fear, it'll just get thrown. My higher power doesn't give me fear. You know, I didn't come into the world. I came into this world with one fear: loud noises. I know this to be true because as babies, loud noises are the only thing that we are supposed to be afraid of. That's what we have, that inherent ability to be afraid of loud noises at birth. Every other fear I learned every other fear here. I learned how to be afraid. You know what? I was afraid of the dark until I was probably 21, 22 years old. The only thing that got me out of that fear of the dark was I loved to bow hunt. And if you're not in the middle of the woods in the dark, you're late. And if you're late, you don't see the deer. I mean, I can't tell you the feelings that I've gone through going into the woods in the morning and climbing up in a tree at 5 o'clock knowing it's not going to get light till 6:30. And sitting up in a tree in the dead of dark knowing there's nothing that could really hurt me, but just sitting there saying, "It's going to get light soon." That's the hope, you know? And it's going to get light soon. I don't get that same comfortable feeling even today when I'm in the woods in the evening. And I know it's going to get darker, 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 and darker. A friend of mine who I work with who's not in recovery had told me once, he said, we were talking about hope, and I was going camping with my daughter earlier in the spring. We were driving out to a campground, and he said, "Do you think Nikki and Deneen will be there when we get there?" And I said, "Honey, I really hope they're there when we get there." She's 3 at this time. She turns to me and says, "Daddy, where is this hope?" Hope, you know? My friend Jeff, who's not in the program of Narcotics Anonymous, had told me once, he said, "Hope is the essential foundation to which faith can be built upon. If you don't have any hope, you'll never have any faith. I get my hope when I come into a meeting at Narcotics Anonymous. That's where the hope was given to me from the first meeting I went to. You know, and faith-based thinking for me is a whole lot more comfortable place to be than fear-based, because fear will make me make a whole lot of, I can make a whole string of bad decisions in fear, none of which are rational. I'll go totally irrational with fear. They were reviewing people at work one day about 5 years ago, and they were saying they had to cut 2 slots. When they said this, I took the morning off. I immediately went to 4 competitors. I was hired by 2 of them on the spot. I came back from my interview at 2 o'clock. The owner of the company said, "You're doing great. You know, you're our number 2 guy this year. You're on your way to maybe being number 1. We're going to have that trip in the Bahamas again. I look forward to it." I walked out of the office thinking, my God, why'd I waste an afternoon in the morning running around thinking that it was going to go any other way? Fear. Fear-based thinking. Now, I want to thank the committee and everybody here. I appreciate you. Thanks.
Thanks, Rick. I would like to introduce the second speaker, Dave. Well, hi, everybody. I'm an addict. My name's Dave. And by the grace of God, I'm clean today. Miracles never cease. I'm so glad the fire's there. It was always my favorite place to be, up in the woods of northern Maine, as we used to get totally rip-roaring insane. Northern Maine is where I really got into my addiction and the insanity of it. It's where I, as we heard earlier tonight, lost the buzz from it and needed it to survive. It was during the times of early childhood that I looked and I saw inside myself nothing. I didn't know who I was, where I was going, what I was doing. And it was a fear. It was an eerie feeling. And I grew up in a good childhood, a good family. Ozzie and Harriet for the 50s. When I joined the Air Force, in high school, I found myself in sports. I did one better than my brother. I played sports. I was a jock. I didn't use. I didn't drink. None of that stuff. I played sports and chased the girls and all that good old high school stuff. Then Vietnam hit. And that's where the party started. It was a thing to do. As time went on, I found my faith in drugs. I didn't say alcohol and other drugs, but just drugs. Because as we say, alcohol is a drug. Say what? Alcohol is a drug. So is drugs. And that was my faith. That was my spirituality. That was my zest. That was my go. So the very thing that made it. I even got married on a jug of Jack and a bag of pot. And that ran out after 12 years. There was a lot of insanity in that, which I used to think was the way of living. I'm sure a lot of us thought about 2 of our years. There was a time in 1985 when my father was extremely sick. This was in Sharon, Pennsylvania. And at the time, my first wife and I and the kids were coming down from Caribou, Maine on vacation. And we stopped in Connecticut at an old friend's house. And I woke up in the morning with the fear of, oh my God, did she know what I did last night? Evidently she did, because she approached me and said, "You ought to walk home. I don't give a shit where you go." So I buttered her up and off we went. Back to Sharon on the rest of our vacation. When I got down here, Dad was real sick. He had been for years. And I took him to the Butler VA hospital. And on the way, I packed a little igloo full 3-beer trip for the way back. And on the way back, he said, "You know, son, that's going to get the best of you." He knew something I didn't know. And I said, "Don't worry, Dad. I got it all under control," without realizing how it controlled me. how it was using them. He died in 1985. That was May. He died and passed on in July 27, 1985. In 1986, November, I cleaned up. He knew what he was telling me. He knew I had a problem. And I wasn't willing to listen at the time. I denied him. Today, there's a star up there that's my dad. My dad's my driving force, my sobriety. He's my guardian angel to God. And I have faith in that. And it's a wonderful feeling inside me. Not only that, my son also has that feeling too, because he shared it with me many times. We had moved to Pennsylvania from northern Maine to help my mother out after Dad passed away as an excuse to get out of work. Now, I had a good job. And it was always work. It was their fault that I wasn't getting anywhere, or hell, they wouldn't advance a bum like I was. Obnoxious, bad mouth, all the good stuff, all the bad stuff I had. So we moved. We moved and took my retirement from civil service, sold my land up there. In 9 months' time, we were broke. $23,000 gone. Borrowed $500, moved back up. And that was May, 1986. By the time I think it was the seventh game of the World Series, right around October, the last October of Halloween, the wife asked for a divorce. And that was the bottom. That was the pit. And I thought I was going insane. Suicidal. Couldn't live without you. All my friends dumped me. They didn't want anything to do with me. So it was just a matter of wanting someone to take me to the rubber room. Up in Maine, up in northern Maine, the mental hospital was at Fort Fairfield, Maine. And I had the stereotype of craziness. Rubber room, bars, all that stuff. So I tried going to an old friend's house. He wasn't home. One of these people would take me there. Everywhere I went, no one was home. So I ended up driving my old pickup over to Fort Fairfield. I walked in there, what can I do for you? And I told him a little bit about myself and all this stuff about drugs. And he says, oh, you're an addict. Chronic alcoholic, all that good stuff. Go to a meeting. They told me what a meeting was. Oh, it's the other meetings, because up there they didn't have in it. So I went. Full depression. And I felt lower than whale crap. You know how big a whale is? That's the biggest critter in the ocean, so they have the biggest droppings, too. And they go pretty low. And that's how low I was. But on that night, as I was going to that meeting, on Route 1, going to Presque Isle, 20 miles away, there's blue lights. There was an OUI roadblock. And I stopped. And I got the biggest chill. The biggest, warmest feeling I could ever have. God was telling me it's okay today. To have faith. To being clean is the way to go. The officer said, have you been drinking or drugging? I said, no, sir. Do you have anything in your vehicle? No, sir. You have a good night. Thank you. And all those years before, I drove wasted. There was pot, there was pills, there was stuff in the vehicle. But never got caught. And always drive in fear, looking over my shoulder. Always had that monkey on my back. And God showed me that one time, as low as I was, is this the place to go? So I went to that meeting, and I found love. And I don't care which one I go to, there's love. Lots of it. The 12 steps gives us that. Lots of love, unity, fellowship. That's what my old crazy eight people didn't give me. That's what the drugs didn't give me. That was the first part of the faith that I found the first night going to a meeting. A little bit after that, going through a divorce, I found that I come out of a small claims court, having to pay for all the lawyer fees for her and all this other stuff, and I had to pay child support, and I had $120 in my pocket. And I threw the checkbook at the judge. He made me apologize. And I went out on the court bench, and I was crying. And the court guard there, whatever they call him, comes by and says, "I wish I could help you, Dave." He knew me from the meetings there, the courthouse meetings on Saturday morning. And I said, "Nothing can help me except for some money." And I was like really a hurting puppy. And I was sober. I was sober for a year. I was clean for a year. And out of nowhere, this guy comes along. He's a young pup. I mean, he was 20, late 20s, early 30s, suit and tie on. He says, "Can I help you?" I said, "You're a lawyer?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "I can't afford my birthday, Social Security number, shadow, let alone a lawyer." He says, "No. I thought maybe we'd go off to one of the rooms and talk. I heard you speak the other night at a meeting." Again, God told me, have faith. People are there. It happened so many times in my life. So when I live in that fear and I hurt, God brings something by. Somebody, something, somehow. Throughout my sobriety, I was married 12 years the first time. Man, I loved marriage. It was wonderful. Kids, the family, the activities, the party, everything about it was, exciting. Then I got divorced. And as I sat on this one retreat place over in Stockholm, Maine, out in the country, similar to this, I was alone. I went on, I think I had 6 months in or so. And I said, "There's a guy up there, 10 years. He just got married. He was telling us about it and everything." I said, "Oh, my God, I won't have to wait that long." You know? So throughout my clean time, it was like calling my sponsor in art. You know, he used to say I was running around like a dog in heat. And always coming up empty-handed. Well, God was helping me out because they say no relationship. So I was getting what I needed, taking care of myself. And I had to learn to accept him on that one. So it took about 10 years of growing in relationships and working through things. And each person that I dated, it seemed like this thing lasted 6 months and ended at Christmas time. Right after Christmas, after I gave them their presents, they said, "See ya, don't want to be ya." And I was crushed. Felt all the old fear and rejection and stuff again. I'd always reach in the bank and say, "There's something to be learned here. I got to have faith. I got to have faith." Well, lo and behold, I too run into the greatest lady in the world, to me. And we both party on life. We both party on our higher powers. She's a gift. And I have faith in that. There's been many things that's happened, and it's only through the 12 steps in the NA program, 12-step programs, that it's given me life. It's given me an attitude of gratitude to look at things in a positive direction so that I can live. And everything isn't just great and groovy and wonderful. So there's down days. Art used to call them growing days. There's no such things as bad. He says, I don't want you to put negative stuff in your head. You have too much. So I was drilled with growing days. There's something to grow from this. So anybody I run into and try to help out, it's growing days. There's no such things as stupid. Like the slogan we have, TIFF. It's not stupid. Just keep it simple, Simon. I don't like stupid. I always thought I was stupid. I was brought up to think I was stupid. And hell, I went to Penn State, graduated in 95, ended up on the dean for 6 out of 8 semesters. I'm not stupid today. I like it. And that's not ego. And that's faith in God. Because if it wasn't for the faith in my higher power in the program, I would have never made it. I proved to myself out of high school That never existed. I dropped out. We had just went through a time here in the last year, my wife and I, of looking for a house. And this is the real God trip. This is a trip of trips for me. And I'm sure he has another one in store. But it was an old schoolhouse up in Utahville, PA, out by Coldport. And as my wife was out, and I were out a year ago, February, running around looking for houses up in that area because she had gotten a job up that way. Riding around, and all of a sudden this thing practically jumped right out in front of me like a telephone pole does to a drunk. So this house jumps right out, and it has a for sale sign on it for this building. And I thought, wow, what a good craft shop, what a good treatment center, and all this other stuff. Then I thought, what a nice home. Well, Johnny wouldn't even get out of the car. You know, she has no way in hell, and I go, yeah. Well, it was like, my dream was always to have a house. I mean, I spent my GI Bill for going to school to be a carpenter and all this, build other people's homes, and I still had that dream. Look, we looked at thousands of homes, and nothing ever suited us. Too low ceilings, not enough room, bathroom too small, not enough closets, one thing or another. It was in town. This one was in the country. This one had a neighbor that no one lived there. This one had a view of, God's beauty. This one had the stars. My dad looks down upon me all the time. When I go out at night up there, I say, hey, how you doing, guy? You know? And we talk. It took us about 9 months to get our mortgage to come through, and it was like mega persistence on my part. My wife wouldn't show her excitement. She refused to, but she thought she'd get, and she told me this many times, thought she'd get disappointed. And we had no credit, very low credit. But we got it. And the day that the mortgage company secured my loan was my recovery anniversary. Another God trip. I go, wow, what a present. On my anniversary. So this thing's meant to be. And she goes, how the heck are you going to build it? You're 51 or 50. I said, have faith, honey. I'll find leverage. You know, I have arthritis and all this stuff. And my mind works today. When I used to build, my mind didn't work, and my bronze did. And I burned that out. I have bad shoulders, I have bursitis in the elbow. Hell, I haven't swung a hammer for years. And I went in there in this old schoolhouse, and I tore it up. Literally tore it up. And it was like, found ways. I had a couple little helps from here and there. People show up, my son or my brother-in-law, and a couple other people, and Joni's son. It's a beautiful place. I had faith that we'd get it. God made it jump out in front of me. And I had a fear of finding out how much it would be. When I did find out, I said, oh, I got to have it. It was very, very little. And we got it. We live there today, and hopefully next summer we'll be able to announce at meetings that we're going to have a retreat up there every once in a while during the summertime. So I know people, I have to give it away to keep it. That's all there is to it. It's just a beautiful God-given place. For me, faith is the way to go. It's a way of thinking. It's a drive. It's an energy. And the counteract to that is the fear. That's the eeriness. That's the empty pit. That's the little kid that was lost. That found his way through drugs. That little kid found his life as an adult in recovery here in the program. Today he's thinking, I'm thinking. My mind works. I've made a decision to turn my will and my life over the care of God as I understand him, her, or it. And as I grew up, and as I used, I knew about God. And I turned to him in haste and in trouble, but not on a daily retrieve, on a daily basis. today it's not a daily basis, it's by the milliseconds, and I'm willing to do that. It's every breathing breath I take. I want God in my life. I need God in my life. It's my driving force. Without being clean, I wouldn't even have God here. And I have faith in that. I've showed myself many times that I had let go of my spirituality. I didn't have spirituality to begin with, except for drugs. And today, it's the driving force. By being clean, it's given me God. And with God in my life, I get treasures. And even during the bottom times, the growing times, I get a treasure. Because I have faith that no matter how low I can go, it's not going to be as low as that time back there in 1986 when I was in the closet and my son found me depressed and with a shotgun in my mouth. Nothing will ever get me that low again. I don't want to go there. And I know what will drive me there. And that's the youth. Today I'll put my will and my life in the care of God as I understand Him in a millisecond, just to prevent that. Just so I can stay clean. Just so I can have faith to accept all the different treasures that He has in store for me. And I have no idea what they're going to be, but I have to do the legwork. I have to make the effort. I went to college. Yeah, me. Stupid me. Went to college. I started in 1991 or two. My first semester was a 3.73. Wow, that's pretty cool. I'm smart. I burned up college. I had a riot. I had a ball. And everything I studied was about alcohol or other drugs. Everything. Everything. Every paper I wrote, it was about it. It used to be exciting to use. Well, I wanted to learn more about it than about this addiction stuff. I wanted to learn more about the disease. But learning that doesn't really, you know, give me recovery or anything. I guess it kind of adds to it by the knowledge. When I got done with school, I wanted to be a counselor, a drug counselor. I ended up working with kids in mental health. And I was pissed. I was really, really upset. I had all the qualifications in the world to treat you, but I couldn't get hired. I got hired in a second, is what they call TSS, therapeutic staff support. And I worked with teenage boys in school and their families in the community. And I was the only staff that I worked with that had any knowledge about alcohol and other drugs. About drugs. And that was useful. I had applied during those 4 years of that job to many different places for a DNA job. And all I do is get turned down. And I started living in fear that I would never get this. My wife says, hey, your quantum leap isn't here yet. You know, our TV program, Quantum Leap, we have our, she and I believe we have these leaps. And I'll have faith that God's going to leap us to the next journey. When He's ready, when we're ready for it, He'll leap us. And we'll make that leap. But we got to do the legwork first. We have to prepare ourselves. Well, out of nowhere, a couple of years ago, I get a phone call from a couple of places. Say, hey, you're still interested in this job. Just out of nowhere. And I was settled in my old job. I was totally settled in it. I was happy. And all of a sudden now, I got a job I'm happy with, and I got the job I've always dreamed about. What do I do? Then all of a sudden, from the state job stuff, I get another opportunity for OVR stuff. I go, oh my God. Now these are good fears, aren't they? Hell no, it drove me nuts. And she wouldn't help me. But I had to put myself in the care of God again. So hopefully I made the right choice. A few things He did to me gave me that direction. I did the legwork, and I made a choice, and I'm in a pretty good spot. One night, looking out the window of the office, I see this very unique star. I was looking for Dad, as I usually am at the stars. And just kind of checking to see if I made the right choice. Do you know this Christmas star has this real big kind of pointies on it? There it was. No way. Huh. No way. That's not for real. And I go back into the group room, come back out, and it's still there. Man, you couldn't knock the face of a higher power out of me, not with a 10-foot stick and a piece of dynamite, and you couldn't drive it out of me. Couldn't drive it out of me. He's given me too many things today that when I have my doubts, man, I got to get out of it and have that faith. I got to have faith. He's shown me too many times. It's too easy sometimes to live into the fear, and it's uncomfortable. That's old behavior and old habits. That gets too close to stinking thinking. Ooh, that's scary. So I got to get out of it. Johnny will give me a couple seconds every once in a while to be in a pity party. Then she'll drive me out of it. And that pity part sucks. It's a place I don't want to be. Where I want to be today is with y'all. I cleaned up in Northern Maine. I moved to Denver, Colorado, my son and I. The first thing I did there was look up meeting. Moved there for a relationship that I learned from, I grew from, and I'm grateful for that it ended. We moved back to Sharon, Pennsylvania, went to school, ended up here in Central Pennsylvania, God's country. And I'm happy as a lark. The only way I can have my happiness is by being clean and by turning my will over. Thank you. I would like to thank the speakers for sharing their experience, strength, and help.